Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, Kyle Hopkins of the Anchorage Daily News, and Peter Granitz of APRN. Jill, the White House releases comparative cost information for medical procedures conducted by hospitals all over the country. The information is startling. The price of the same medical procedure can vary wildly from hospital to hospital, even with some hospitals that are just a few blocks apart. You've worked on this story, you've done a lot of research and writing. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this data that was released from the White House basically confirms, I think, what consumers and other healthcare industry watchers have suspected for a long time, which is that the pricing is just crazy. It's out of whack, and it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to someone who's on the outside of the system. You see this database that they released of common procedures that are coded through a common code across the system, across the nation, and you have these wildly different prices. An extreme example is a spinal fusion. And in a hospital in Maryland, it may cost $21,000, but in a hospital coming out of New Jersey, that same procedure, at least the way it's coded, is $471,000, which is just an astronomical increase. And we see similar disparities, not to quite that degree, even right here in Alaska, between the hospitals that are in the University Medical District in Midtown Anchorage and across the state. And so the question is, why are these disparities so great? What's driving them? Does it mean anything to the average consumer? And in speaking with people that watch the industry, people that are inside the hospital industry, they don't think that for most consumers, those who are covered in some way with insurance, it's really going to matter that much. It's probably going to matter what kind of coverage you have. Do you have Medicaid? Do you have private insurance? Because Medicaid's only ever going to pay so much. Well, the no insurance ones are the folks that may be needing to pay the closest attention to this as general medical consumers. Medicaid prices, that same $471,000 procedure in New Jersey was only getting reimbursed, you know, between $20,000 to $40,000, the same rate that all of the other hospitals across the country and in Anchorage were getting reimbursed. So why is that happening? We were told hospitals have had this kind of strange, complicated procedure for setting prices and trying to recover costs. And a lot of times they are inflated. It's like a retail price, but it's never the price that people or that they think they're actually going to recover. They know Medicaid will only pay X amount. They're going to shift some of that perhaps undercompensated burden to the private insurers, but they know the private insurers are also going to negotiate downward. So it's kind of a game. You set your prices high, you negotiate down a little bit, and then every insurance company is probably going to have a different rate of pay that they're willing to agree upon. So for those who are uninsured, though, it's possible you could see that retail bill. And so what we heard from people who were trying to offer advice for consumers to make some sense of this data, and hospitals themselves are trying to make sense of this data, is it might pay to shop around. It may pay to go and check out facilities, make sure that they offer comparable service, comparable care. You know, you don't want to buy lesser care for yourself if it's going to put you and your family at risk.
Doesn't that put you in a pretty tough situation as a consumer about how to be a knowledgeable consumer?
I think
I'm
so.
I'm going to have my nose worked on. There are four or five people in town who can do it. How do I know which is the one?
I can't answer that. I mean, certainly there's mechanisms in place to know if doctors or facilities have had major problems. Those are part of health department records.
You can find out if they've been
sued. Check up on that kind of thing. But they said, you know, so the advice for an uninsured consumer was maybe you should shop around, negotiate the deepest discount you can for the procedure off the bat, provided you have time. You know, you're not in an emergency situation. And then start looking for other programs that the hospital may offer to help you manage those costs from there. And hospitals do have programs that are available to people that are having a difficult time paying. The other pressure that will probably come out of this is that the insurance companies and competing hospitals and facilities are going to take a look at this data and maybe realign their cost structures, thinking that they can get something better out of it. And of course, hospitals have to make a living. Pay for the services, the cost of living, their employees, keep themselves staffed, keep themselves open.
Right.
And in every community and in every facility, some procedures may be more cost effective for them to bill out at higher rates than others, which I'm told is also what may have accounted for some of the disparity. Now,
a couple of things here. The Native Hospital was included in this work. Mm-hmm. Aren't they in some way underwritten by the federal government in a way that would make their costs and what they need to for these various services different than the other two major hospitals here?
I don't believe so. I know that we had heard those remarks, and in fact, one of our examples was one procedure at Providence is twice as expensive as it is at the Native Hospital, but then you had other procedures at the Native Hospital that were the most expensive in the state of Alaska compared to other facilities. They all have to recover their costs from somewhere, and their money has to go to pay for the procedures and the care that they're offering. And what we're looking at are the basic retail prices, and I don't believe that those retail prices are being set with a consideration of some kind of subsidy in place.
And finally, we need to move on here, but don't have enough time. It was a surprise to you as a reporter that Alaska turned out in the middle of the pack of the 50 states?
It was really surprising to me. I kind of figured we would be at the high end, and that might have been an unfair assumption. And the other part of that is that when it comes to the Medicaid reimbursement, we're actually at the high end of Medicaid. So we're kind of in the middle of the pack for the retail prices that people are charging for these procedures, but we're recovering more from Medicaid than other communities outside the state might be.
Okay, Peter Granitz, the Obama administration is awash in controversy. First, the lingering debate about who knows what and when about the Benghazi killings, and then the IRS misbehavior, and finally the Justice Department digging into the Associated Press. What does this mean for Democrats, and especially Mark Begich, Democrats who are seeking re-election next year?
It depends on the Democrat. They can play this really well. No smart politician in the country will say they're happy about the IRS story. But internally, I bet a lot of them actually are. It gives them a chance to come out and say, I hate the IRS. I've always hated the IRS. Here's my chance to trash it. Senator Begich was the first in the delegation, I think it was a week ago. You know, remember this story is 7 days long, and that's, you know, 7 days worth of stories in Washington. But it came out a week ago, and Senator Begich was the first in the delegation to come out and say, the IRS needs to stop targeting political organizations. I don't recall the specific remark, whether he mentioned that it was conservative or not, but regardless, he came out in advance. And I think for any Democrat who wants to do that, or any lawmaker who wants to do that, here's a really good chance. Gives you a chance to distance yourself from arguably an unpopular president. And that's a really important thing to do in the likes of Alaska, Montana, Louisiana, Arkansas, definitely in Arkansas. But Senator Begich has been on top of this. It might be a bigger issue in the House, where some Democrats might actually say that they have a chance of retaking it. There, where you're up every 2 years again, and politics tend to be a little bit deeper there, where you have to run every 2 years. It might be a bigger issue in the House than the Senate.
Okay. Is there a danger here that the American people are going to suffer some kind of Obama fatigue if he's shrouded in this negativity, and that this could be taken out on Democrats?
It's entirely possible. I mean, you look back at, was it 1998? The cycle after Bill Clinton got reelected, you know, he had to deal with Monica Lewinsky. George W. Bush had to deal with Katrina in his second term. You know, all the way back to Lyndon Johnson, you know, when he had his political capital, he used it on the Vietnam War. And you can count any number of historians who say that he wasted his political capital on his really strong social welfare programs on Vietnam. So you can look back and see that, and I think there is a really good argument to be made that, you know, immigration advocates are really concerned that the president, who should really be cheerleading this immigration proposal, whatever comes out, is going to be spent dispelling rumors or addressing scandal, and that's not a good position for
right,
a president.
Right. Okay, thank you. Kyle, a couple of stories. One, you recently had a story that painfully illustrates a much larger social problem. The story involved a 57-year-old woman in Mountain Village who died from an overdose of home brew, or she may have choked on the drinking that home brew. Who was the woman? What happened to her? And what does this tell us, a larger question about alcohol abuse in Alaska?
Well, I think something like that is, it's a story for us because not because of one incident or kind of what happened to one person, but just the idea that occasionally it's worth, you know, reminding ourselves that that life in Alaska is different than lower 48, and life in the villages especially is different than in the city. You know, this is a dry village, of mountain village on the river, and unlike in other states,
it's on the Yukon, right?
On the Yukon, and I think it's on the Kuskokwim, because it's near Bethel, but it's a dry community, and a dry community in another state would mean that you can't, there's no bar, right? Or there might not be a liquor store, so you can't buy it on your block, but you could drive across, you could drive 15 minutes, and you can go get something to drink. Well, in this village, unless you're going to fly somewhere, unless you're going to fly to Anchorage, you can't go to a bar, you can't go to a liquor store. And so what happens is you have a community where people say that a dozen or more people kind of make a habit of making homemade alcohol, right? And as a result, you have an unpredictable type of alcohol that people are drinking. And one thing I didn't put in that story is that after the day after I heard from the chief of staff for the Bethel hospital, where if you're, if there's a medical emergency, you're flown to Bethel, and she said that they're concerned about the unpredictability of homebrew. But what they see is, like, especially if it's someone who's drinking a lot and drinking for the first time, that's where they get into trouble, because it's not like buying something, it's not like buying a six pack of beer over the counter where you kind of know what you're getting. You're getting, who knows what you're getting, and it doesn't quite taste like alcohol because it's mixed with other things. And so it's just kind of a particular problem, I think, in dry communities, on the coast or along the North Slope, where alcohol is not readily available, and people are going to drink, and so they make it themselves.
And I guess that we've had any number of programs that have attempted to deal with alcohol abuse, and just you say this is a dry village, right?
Yeah, I mean, these are communities where you can, and people have been, I don't know if they've successfully been prosecuted, but people have been charged with owning yeast and certain amounts of yeast and sugar, as if they were, the same way that someone might be charged with kind of owning, baking soda and kind of the ingredients to make drugs. Every once in a while, I think there's a crackdown or there's an effort to crack down on it, along with bootlegging. I mean, the homebrew issue is a little bit separate, and it's kind of hard to tease out because we know that a lot of people die from alcohol-related causes in Alaska, mm-hmm. and the rates are much higher in the bush, but whether that has to do with homebrew or over the counter.
One thing, an economics question. Do you have any idea how much cheaper making? I mean, I have to assume homebrew is cheaper in a village than it would be to import your favorite brand name. But do you have any idea of I guess what it costs depends on how much you make.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's the supply and demand in the village, and on how much are you going to pay? If you're going to pay for a fifth of alcohol that is shipped in from
right,
a store
right.
here, troopers will tell you that that's. I think those numbers are often inflated. I think law enforcement sometimes inflates like what people are actually paying for those, because they'll tell you like $150,
yeah.
$100-something, and I don't know about that. Like what people are actually paying. What does it cost to make to make or sell it yourself? I don't know. I've heard numbers, but I would be kind of guessing
okay.
at how
all
much
right,
they're
right.
paying.
Jill, you've been looking at the Obama administration's national strategy for the Arctic region. What is it, and why is it important at this time?
I think, the biggest important aspect of this is a symbolic one. It was announced just prior to the meeting of the Arctic Council in Sweden that took place last week. It's kind of the next development of articulated intent about what the nation wants to do with the Arctic that came after an Arctic policy was first developed under a former administration. Then we get to President Obama's administration, and now we have not just a policy but a strategy. And that strategy, in my impression, is just kind of the kitchen sink strategy. They want everything. They want, military infrastructure and resources. They want to be able to protect the top of the world. They want to maintain the cultures of the indigenous and coastal people up there. They want to protect the environment. They want to promote resource development. They want to watch, monitor, and keep safe,
yeah.
keep safe all of the Arctic shipping. And they want to be adaptable and respond to climate change in a meaningful and considered way. And so kind of all of the issues that you hear about when you think about the Arctic today in 2013 were discussed in this policy or in this strategy as being things that they are firmly committed to and want to pursue. But it stopped short of, the document stopped short of making specific commitments. It didn't pledge to build a port. It didn't pledge to increase security. It didn't pledge to do a better job monitoring marine traffic. It just said, these are the things that we would like to do. And that was one of the criticisms that came out about the document from people with a stake in Alaska who've been paying close attention to this. That having been said, we were told that it is very significant that you have something signed by the president of one of the Arctic nations joining other Arctic nations in their commitment to be responsible, considered, thoughtful, and up to date in an approach to how you manage and invest in the Arctic. And I guess I would add that the last thing that came out of it, two other things that were important coming out of it, was a lot of reference to consulting with local entities and governments and tribal entities from all levels, so it's not just the feds coming in and ramming their ideas through. And then the second was this mention that they have to enter a new era and look at private partner and multinational cooperation and partnerships, public-private partnerships and multinational investment to make some of these goals come true.
Thank you. Peter, Senator Lisa Murkowski returns from a meeting of the Arctic Council in Sweden. What is the Arctic Council and why was she there, following up on what Jill just told us?
The Arctic Council is the group of eight polar nations. It was formed in 1996. And I'm unclear as to the authoritative body as to what kind of laws it can create, but it does come up with agreements. This past week, the eight nations came up with a partnership on oil spill prevention. I don't think this is something along the lines of like an Exxon Valdez, but actually like emissions from oil and tankers and things like that. The previous one, 2 years ago, they came up with an agreement for asset sharing on search and rescue types of things. Alongside the eight polar countries are what are called six permanent participants. Those are organizations of natives. You've got Aleuts represented, the Sami in Russia, Athabascan, you name it. You know, as I understand it, there are natives from every continent and every Arctic nation represented. The big to-do this week was granting observer status to six non-Arctic nations: China, Singapore, South Korea, Japan, India and Italy. Italy, of course, we hear as being in terrible debt, but they have a strong interest in energy in the North Slope, in the North Slope, but also Arctic life. Lisa Murkowski was there as she went to the last one, I believe, to make the case. The United States will chair the commission in a couple of years. The biannual conference will be in Alaska. So she was there to press Alaska's issues, I suppose.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to go to Kyle now. And Kyle, you had a remarkable story on Sunday about events that does happen in Alaska from time to time can have terrible consequences, namely an airplane crash. This was near Takatna. Tell us about this remarkable story.
This story came from, the origins are from this year's Iditarod, when we were just having a hard time flying from village to village, especially in that area, you know, kind of McGrath and Takatna and west of there. And, you know, we were flying from McGrath to Takatna and couldn't get in. It was kind of whiteout conditions and it was a little spooky, and you're kind of watching the pilot to see what he was going to do. And he said, yeah, I don't think it's going to happen. We're going to turn around. And then the weather's kind of closing in behind you. I was thinking about that, and, you know, in the plane, thinking that, well, this is the same, and someone else in the plane mentioned that this was kind of the same area that there was a plane crash 2 years prior, right, a fatal plane crash where two people died, where this longtime pilot from Anvik, or who grew up in Anvik, died, and this teacher, this kind of beloved teacher from Anvik died. And there were four other people in the plane, and we had never written much about the four other people except to say that they were in serious condition or in fair condition, right? And so when I got home, I just thought, well, you know, I'd like to, because I've been wanting to write more about kind of what happens after a plane crash. It's something I've been thinking about a lot lately. And this family had moved to Maine, and you know, what I didn't realize was that the mother was pregnant. You know, this was a family that had moved from Texas, because they had been a military family. They moved up from Texas. They were going to start their Alaska adventure as school teachers in Anvik. And they had spent the summer there, and they're kind of excited to start the school year. And so they were taking what's really a short flight from McGrath to the village of Anvik on the Yukon.
Minutes.
What's like an hour-long flight? They were maybe 20 minutes into it, but you know, they weren't going across the state. They were just kind of making a hop from a hub, you know, to a village, right? And they passed Takotna. They were in, it wasn't white out because it wasn't snow, but it was, they had kind of no visibility. And, you know, they hit a mountain and, you know, two people were killed immediately in that crash. And the rest were unconscious. And it was this family of four, including, you know, the father and the mother who were sharing a teaching job. It was kind of the first teaching job. They were trying to decide to do with their lives, and they thought they would kind of have this adventure in Alaska. The father had been in both the Marines and the Army, and he was not really a people person. He kind of wanted to get out into the bush, but he liked kids, and so we thought, well, maybe this is a good fit. And the school district kind of embraced them. So anyway, the father wakes, you know, he became conscious. He was kind of the first to wake up in the plane and was unaware that anyone else was alive. He thought everyone was dead. And so the story is just kind of, you know, just what happened over the next 14 to 15 hours as they're trying to survive. And it turns out there were many fortuitous things. You know, this is a religious family, and they kind of see the hand of God in some of the things that happened to them. Their little girl had made her first quilt, you know, like a few days before, and that quilt was, you know, in the plane, and they used it to wrap her up. And there were, you know, there were just things they brought along with them that kind of helped them survive you know, through the night until they were rescued the next morning. And then
I think, let me just interject quickly, that how the dad was able to move when he was so severely injured is also
remarkable. That's the other thing I didn't realize when that plane crash happened was how badly hurt the parents were. They both had broken backs.
Yeah.
And they still at the present time are suffering the consequences of their injuries, right? They're in Maine now
and not bedridden, but trying to sort through whether or not they'll be able to kind of work for a living. You know, will they still be able to have, they still want to be teachers, but
had was a life-changing event. Yeah.
Right. You know, there was a reporter who used to work for the paper, who now works in Maine, who just kind of happened to work in Maine. So we just, you know, he was able to kind of catch up with them and talk about what their life is like now in Maine, which is a struggle.
We better leave it right there. Jill, following in your early discussion of hospital, let's turn to Medicaid, more specifically Medicaid fraud, which you've taken a look at.
Right. So the state is starting to crack down. They've probably been cracking down for a while, but they have a new attorney general in the Medicaid fraud unit. And they are looking at, I guess, what could be considered low-hanging fruit, kind of the on-the-ground caregivers who are getting reimbursed for the services that they provide to Medicaid recipients, personal care attendants, people who are in a position to maybe offer personal services, help with daily tasks of living, keep the house clean, get you to the grocery store, get you to and from doctor's appointments. And they've uncovered in the last 10 months or so, 9 months, tens of thousands of dollars in fraudulent billing. So they've gone after these folks to try to prosecute them and send a message that this won't be tolerated. And so what you have in some cases is people billing for patients who were actually out of the country at the time, people who were billing for the same hours on the same days for multiple clients. There's no way they could be in two places at once. People who have a day job doing something else who were billing for hours caring for someone while they were at their day job. And then in one really egregious case, somebody who had a client who really needed the help, a diabetic man who wasn't really cognizant of his full health needs, whose feet were rotting off because of complications with diabetes. They never set foot inside the house and instead would just pass the time slips through the window, get them signed, and then ship them off.
And
for
what
payment.
Kind of penalties quickly do these people get, or does it depend on the dimension of the crime?
It depends on the dimension of the crime. So far, nobody's gotten jail time, but they have gotten some fines, and they have been forced to pay restitution, and they are prohibited from working and getting reimbursed by Medicaid ever again. So it changes the dynamics of perhaps not only the money that's coming into a family if it's a family caregiver, but also your ability to work that job.
Okay, we only got a couple minutes left. We'll try for 1 minute with each of our remaining guests. Let's go to Peter Granitz. Peter, Governor Parnell and Dan Sullivan, the Attorney General, or the Commissioner, are going to have a teleconference on Monday. Tell us about it.
Governor Parnell will stay in Alaska, and Commissioner Dan Sullivan will be in D.C. They're slated to announce at the Chamber of Commerce a big announcement for drilling on federal land. People tell me that's the state is willing to spend some tens of millions of dollars for seismic research somewhere in Anwar, presumably the coastal plain, an attempt to force the federal government's hand to allow this. It's unlikely to lead to anything.
Okay. And Kyle, headline, Musher plans to fight to keep sled dog alive after a mauling in a dog kennel.
Well, I think, you know, sometime next month, there'll be a hearing to decide whether or not the sled dog should die after it, you know, attacked this a two-year-old, almost three-year-old girl at the kennel of Iditarod and Yukon Quest musher Jake Berkowitz. And real quickly, I think there's a dispute about exactly who is to blame between, you know, the kennel owners, the family that owns the kennel, and then the family that was visiting.
Now, is this in any way a criminal matter, or would this be a civil matter?
This would be civil, and, you know, and we should probably watch for a civil lawsuit. But it's I don't think the owners are in danger of being charged with anything.
Well, we're in danger of running out of time. Thank you very much for joining us here on Alaska Edition. We'll see you next week right here.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublicmedia.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.